Welcome, everybody, to my first podcast with Dante Luna, my dear friend. Our first podcast. My makeshift boom arm. For now, I'll have to hold it. So, I think a good introduction would be, you know, talking about how we met. Let's talk about UCLA, shall we?
Yeah, I fucking hated UCLA. No, I'm just kidding. But, yeah, we met in M10, which was a study. I don't even know what that class was for, really. All I knew is that I had to take it. And it was interesting, but it seemed to be a whole lot of nothing at the end. A whole lot of everything, but a whole lot of nothing.
Wow.
You know, the coolest part about that class was we got to study music from the present to the, like, ancient past, I believe. I think that's the way they went.
I think that's what they wanted us to take away from it. I don't think it was supposed to be much more than a music history class. I think they did a pretty good job at that, if that's what it was supposed to be. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's what it was, right? Music history. It wasn't really theory or anything.
They kind of tried to work everything into it, and remember there was, like, performances and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was a hodgepodge, and they still have to take it, but they call it something else now, I believe. But it was iconic at the same time. I kind of enjoyed that class because there was no other class really like that I took at UCLA where all of the music majors were in one place.
Yeah. Yeah, I never would have.
And not just music, but like ethnomusicology and like world. Or no, that's the same thing. Ethnomusicology.
What's the other one? Well, ethno is like an umbrella for jazz, world, and other.
But there was like one more like music. History? No, music education. Music ed.
Yeah, yeah.
So all those majors were in one room, and that's where I met you, Max. Ooh, I don't remember exactly the moment though.
I was thinking about this before. Did we start playing together for a project? It might have been like a Fela Kuti. Do you remember that? Weren't we?
Was that with Nicole?
Which Nicole? Nicole Cohen.
Cohen, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that was later, I think. I think we did something with her. I know I did. I gigged with her for like a year. But I remember being in a group with a few other musicians before someone saying like, "Oh, we should get Dante because we don't have a drummer or percussionist." And I think that's how it happened. I was with a couple girls in my group and we didn't have a bass player or a drummer, and then I think that's how you and Cole ended up in it. But I'm not certain. I think that's what happened though.
That sounds about right. Do you remember who those two girls were?
It was what is her name? I only know her by her Instagram name now. She She has such a great voice. It was and Nicole Andrews might have been in our group. She sings and plays guitar.
Right.
But it was. She's black. I don't remember. Her name.
As something.
Isn't
a?
Her?
Is there was an A and there's a Z in it.
But I'm not sure if that's her actual name. Like,
I'm friends with her on Facebook, and she posts like all these political things all the time. Is that her?
That's her. Yeah. Like I think the name's, the screen name is like Azalea or something.
Yeah.
But she has a. He has another name. I don't remember it.
But. Well, do you remember she was always like bringing up like the black diaspora in class, being like, you know, this like I don't know. I thought it was just kind of funny, like. No matter what we were talking about, like tied back to like some political issue she was wrapped up in, and I, you know, I feel like everyone, like as soon as she started talking, would be like, "All right, here we go," for like another 5 minutes.
Well, people, like it's not their fault really. They want to feel like they're helping an issue, and they, so much so that they care about it on like a moment to moment level. Like, how can I make this a part of everyone else's life too, whenever I have the opportunity? And I don't think people necessarily appreciate that. But
well, it's like it's 9 a.m. on a Monday or something, like, or Tuesday. I don't remember which day it was on. Or yeah, but that, wow, so many memories are flooding back. This was freshman year for me. Were you
I was a sophomore.
Wow. 2014, I believe, or 2015. Because yeah. I was there the whole year. Did you come in like the winter quarter or something?
I was there in the, so I took all my GEs before that year, and then, because I was like, do I want to do the music program? Do I not? And so I was like, well, I have to try it. And so the next year I started taking all the classes. And then after that year, I started to focus on a different major. But I ended up taking like so many of the classes that it's almost like I did a double major.
I remember seeing you around the building a lot.
You'd oh, yeah.
Run into you. It'd be like, you're here again.
Yeah.
But it felt like you actually were a music student.
Yeah. Well, I was. I was on paper. I was first music history and then world music. And I was really digging it until I started looking at the coursework for like later on, and maybe I would have liked it more being like a little older, but for some reason I was very like narrow minded, I guess, in how I learned, and I was like kind of unwilling to consider someone else's way. You know, I kind of regret that because it would have been fun to see you guys around more. But
well, I don't blame you. Music school is kind of whack. It's like, what? Why? Unless you want to be a music teacher. Well, I don't know. It's different for everybody. You know, I can see that, but like I feel like they should tell you what their their mission is, because I feel like they don't really, like, they're kind of sneaky about it. They're like, oh yeah, you know, well, you want to be a musician, come to music school. You want to write music, come to music school. But secretly, they're preparing you. They're like grooming you to become a professor at that same school or somewhere else really, but that's the only thing they can really do with your degree. Like, being a musician, like, you don't have to be a good musician to graduate. That's the thing. You don't have to be a good composer to graduate. You just have to have, like, completed all the courses. And that's kind of easy.
There is a bit of grooming that goes on, for sure. It is for profit as well. That's the only reason we have something in general. I can only think that's why we have them. Some schools are all about, you know, merit and ideas, but a lot of schools just want to make a profit, and it's not all motivated by that. Sure, but as soon as jazz became a thing, you know, all these jazz schools started popping up. And I mean, we weren't alive for that, but I hear that's really how it happened. Like, there was no such thing as a jazz school, because all of that was normally something to happen outside of a school setting.
Yeah, you know, what I thought was really cool, just speaking of jazz schools, is, like, I studied in Italy one summer before I did my master's at UCLA. And I remember there was, like, the school I was at, which is, like, a typical European music school that you would imagine in Europe. But, like, for some reason, I had forgotten that, like, jazz was, like, like, beyond America. Like, mm-hmm. And there was, like, a whole separate building that was massive that was dedicated just for jazz. Like, they were completely separate things, but, like, just as valued. And, like, had just as much resources. And I was just, like, it wasn't as old, but it was still, like, in a really great facility. And I was just like, damn, they really like jazz here. Like, who would have thought Italians like jazz? But alas, I'm just an ignorant American traveling abroad.
People love that about our culture. It's one of the only pure art forms to come from here. Because usually, in some ways, every new form or style is like a hybrid, but I would say jazz is one of America's art forms that's mostly originated there and wasn't just sort of like another iteration of previous styles or genres. And people around the world, they love that about us, and they probably wish more of us were a part of that, because there's this whole other side of that's not involved in, you know, America's art at all. And so my feeling is that a lot of people around the world probably like America just for this small sliver of inventiveness that we've had, even though that sounds like I'm giving America flack. Like, we've done so many
beautiful things. Nah, I think everybody knows. We don't need to say.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, people know. But, yeah, there's jazz.
We'll blow up your country. All right. I was kidding. I'm just kidding. But
there's jazz everywhere, man. Italy, France, Netherlands, Japan.
South America, the moon. I don't know about the moon.
Cuba. We should take a trip to Cuba now that you can, you know, and then we can meet the Yoruba people. I actually, the student I have on Sundays, his daughter did that. He has a connection in Cuba. She has a connection in Cuba to the Yoruba tribe. And so she went and learned drumming from them. And it was pretty rough. Like, I think she had to sleep on like a really old like mattress in like kind of a shoddy place, but like that's what you sign up for when you want to learn something special in, you know, in a place like that.
Yeah, my dad did something in Cuba once. Are those birds? That's or is it an alarm? I don't know. That's the sound was happening earlier. But like, my dad went to Cuba once and he brought back these instruments, like these Cuban maracas, and like some bongos or whatever. But part of me wants to like go there and be there, but I know I'm gonna like destroy my hand playing hand drums, because every time I play hand drums, like I go ham. I like go full out and I make sure I get those high snare sounds or like that's just like the slaps. But I don't practice hand drums every day. So every time I'm done, I get these bruises on my knuckles and my hands all swollen. But it sounded good. So I can like make it, I can make it last like one day or two, but any longer than that, it's going to be like no more hands on my hands, no more skin in my hands.
When you're doing hand drumming, do you have to, is there a certain level of volume that you have to maintain in order to stay in the pocket? Because I feel like I try to be able to play longer by playing more gently, but then I can't get the tone right, and sometimes I'm playing so gentle that I end up being too loose. And then it's not even worth it that I could play longer, because I'm not playing how I want to be playing.
The volume, I think, change like the faster you go, the softer you're gonna want to play, and then the slower you are, the louder you're gonna want to play. So I think like the best volume to play at, just in general, is a medium. Because you're not working too hard, but also people can hear you.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I think like if you're playing fast, and you're playing a lot of subdivisions, playing softly and closer to the drum is easier. Because if you're playing loud and fast, there's a lot of motion that you have to cover, like a lot of distance. And it's harder to keep up for a longer time. So it's easier if you have a smaller motion. You don't have to travel as much height-wise.
That makes a lot of sense. So medium. And you said you can only do hand drumming for like a couple days. How much would you have to be doing it? Like all day?
No, just like for a couple hours. Like,
oh, damn.
Like I had a gig several months ago where I had to play this one song, just where I was playing djembe the whole time, and I was the only person playing djembe, and I was playing with a choir and a couple other percussionists. And it started off with me like blah blah da blah da blah da blah blah da da blah da blah da blah blah da da blah, something like that. And I had to, you know, fill up a whole venue with my sound, no mics. So yeah, I'm going hard, but I change the velocity when I'm not playing on the beat, like when I'm playing on main big beats, I hit it hard because everybody needs to feel where that is, and they need to believe in me. I know where the beat is, or like they need to have that foundation. But the notes in between, I can kind of ghost them even sometimes. It doesn't matter. Like people can capture those nuances after the fact. But for example, like that, we had rehearsals. We had like one rehearsal and then like a week off. Something like that. And another rehearsal and then a week off. Wait. I don't remember. It was something like that. It was like a rehearsal and then maybe the next day there was a concert. And then we had another concert the day after. That's what it was. So, yeah, one rehearsal, two concerts. And by the last concert, the second concert, I would say, boom, that's perfect. That's because my hands are done now. Like, I'm done. And then I recorded Cajon for one of my old UCLA professors, Ian Krause, for his some arrangement he did for guitar and string quartet of a Led Zeppelin song, I think. And he wanted me to play Cajon. And it was a killing arrangement. So, and he only had like three parts that the Cajon was in. And I just had to play those parts. But by the end, I was only there for an hour. But my hands were beat red, especially my right hand, because that does all the slaps, the top corner. If I actually practiced hand drums, I wouldn't have that problem.
You get used to it.
Yeah, but luckily I don't have to do it very often, and I can kind of get by for now. But we'll see how long my luck will last.
Is piano anything like that for you? How much until you feel like you need a break? Like a long break. Like, you know, a day off.
Piano's a little different. I mean, a lot of the things I play are actually not too challenging, but like sometimes there will be like if I'm starting to get tired, I notice that it's a technical thing. Like I can actually fix that, and I can alleviate some of that tension with my technique, and that will make me go longer. It's a little bit different. Like you can, it's not like a force. You know, you're not like slamming your hand against something. You're gently pressing keys, so it doesn't really have that. But sometimes, you know, in this area, your wrist through forearm, maybe even shoulder, if you're not really conscious of your position and your body, that can be problematic. But it's worth it, because then you can practice longer, you can play longer.
I used to wail on the keys when I had, like, no technique at all. And just because I needed a certain amount of force to get the sound, like, even enough. And in in time as much as I could. Because, like, I wasn't efficient enough where I would be able to just play lightly and get to all the notes that I want to get to without expending a lot of energy. So it was like really exhausting for a little while, and probably didn't have to be, but I guess I had this notion that I actually had to play a bit more like forcefully to like kind of overcorrect for not having the technique yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it amazes me when I see like a real monster pianist. That's kind of the word for them, the people who are just beasts at the instrument. They don't look like they're working that hard, but they're blowing the roof off. You know, they're like, I forget his name, but I actually played this in the percussion section for Stravinsky's Les Noces, is how it's pronounced if you're American. But Les Noces, I think, is how it's pronounced in French. I'm not sure. But it's like the wedding, I think. The wedding. It's about the wedding. And it is such a great piece. It's for four. It was originally written for four pianos and a percussion section, I believe, with choir and soloists. And this was the first union gig I ever did. I'll always remember it. And it was amazing. I was playing with my teacher in the percussion section. And another one of my teachers was playing piano, Gloria Chang, monster pianist. And like the pianist in the LA Phil, the woman, I forget her name, she was also in there. And then another pianist who plays with the LA Opera and like a whole myriad of other places in LA, he was there. And then someone else. Oh, I think she works at CalArts, this one woman. But they were just all there. And I was just like, because the parts there, they're like, they're, instead of an orchestra, you have four pianos. Just imagine that. So like the sound that comes from that is just so powerful. And like they just, boom, like their hands, their wrists just look different. And I don't want to mess with them. I don't want to do an arm wrestling match with them. I don't want to do a thumb wars because they will beat me.
That's something that takes so long. Like I had the idea that you could get a lot of it within the first few years, and I think that's kind of true, but you really need to be like that. Wrists like that come from a lifetime of that kind of playing.
Yeah, definitely a lifetime. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, like, the career you can have as a pianist. There's obviously the accompanist is the most, like, utilized, I'd say, like, being an accompanist for dance classes or singers, opera. But then what comes with that usually is your sight reading abilities. So like you can't really be a good accompanist unless you know a lot of repertoire and can read and learn music very quickly, like in hours.
Like how quickly would you say, like what would the repertoire be like for one of these dance classes and how long would you have to learn it?
Sometimes 0 seconds, like literally, like, or just a matter of seconds. Cause like, I've seen this firsthand, cause I grew up partly in Georgia, where my dad was one of the main ballet teachers at the Atlanta Ballet School. And I became friends and knew all the accompanists. I mean, I was a kid and they were all adults, but like, I ended up getting lessons from a lot of them, and like I would be sitting next to them in class because I had nothing to do, just kind of watching them. And one guy, he had it all figured out. Like a lot of the pianists, they have like songs that they do that they've been doing for years. But my dad, as a ballet teacher, he would always kind of keep the accompanists on their feet, which I would hate if I was an accompanist. But like, he always did, and some of the accompanists kind of rolled with it. But my dad would be like, "Oh, you know this song," and he would just hum it. And it would be like some movement from a ballet or like some song from a musical, and he wouldn't even know the name or the musical name at all. But then the accompanist would have to like just figure it out. And this one, a particular one, he brought a monitor that he attached to the piano. He had like a page turning pedal before they were very popular, and another computer. He'd be like looking up shit on the fucking fly and somehow find it in the library and then just sight read it. That kind of shit is amazing to me. I'm just like, and you can like, I can kind of do that. Like I like doing that with my friends sometimes, like, you know, like karaoke. It's very hard.
Isn't there, on that level, isn't there like a limited amount of choices that you have with each layer? For instance, let's say you pull up the song that you haven't heard. Suppose you know where the melody falls in each bar. That already gives you an idea of what the harmony would be like. And But by that level, you've played so much repertoire, so many different pieces that you have so many ways to arrange under your belt that it's almost irrelevant what the left hand might be doing or what the supporting notes are doing. So is it mostly a matter of hearing melodies, just hearing them on a high level and being able to read them quickly?
Yeah, I think there's a good deal of ear training and like knowledge of harmony, chord progressions, and stylistic idioms. So like knowing where your 5/1s are, knowing when it goes to the relative minor, like, and like ways of getting there. I think they all had that, like they knew that, like the back of their hand in every single key. And then also different like types of textures, like waltzes, polkas, tangos, you know, things in six, things in four, so like all kinds of things. Actually, there was one of the accompanists who's since passed. His name is Ronnie Ray. Rest in peace. But he was so funny, and all of these pianists, by the way, they all smoke cigarettes like on the break. Like I always saw them outside smoking cigarettes. Like they could care fucking less. They hated their job, it seemed.
No.
Like they all seemed miserable. Like I don't know if you seen Gershwin or no, the Fantasia, when they have the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue, and there's that one guy who wants to be a jazz pianist or drummer or something. No, the jazz pianist, I think, with like the dark circles under his eyes. They all look like that. But anyway, this guy Ronnie Ray, he had his like, you know, like a cigarette sounding scratchy throat all the time. But I had like I had lessons with him like all summer, so like for like 2 or 3 months, and the whole time we just learned how to fake it. Like he said, you know, we were like, what are you going to learn? And he just said, you know, let me show you how to fake it. And it was the weirdest thing. I was just like, what do you mean fake it? Like you're still doing it. But like what he said, he's like, you give the impression of the song without giving all the information. Cause like what he was teaching me is when you look at a piece of music, just looking at it, and you only have like seconds or less to like be able to play it like relatively perfectly, or to a point where people recognize a tune and can follow along and you don't skip a beat. So even if you mess up, you kind of keep going. That was one of the things. But then also kind of reading the bass line and letting the bass inform a lot of things. So you just kind of read the bass on top, and then you can fill in the rest a lot of the time.
That's what I was wondering about. And it sounds like that's the strategy. It's just break it down to what has to be happening and then... and sort of triage the situation, like, okay, I don't need to read the inner voices necessarily. I mean, maybe if you can read them and catch them, great. But what's the bare framework of the song?
Yeah, I mean, and it's crazy. Like later, this became. It just became something that came up in my life again, this kind of idea of faking it, when I was studying at another school in Europe and was taking score reading and keyboard harmony. And those things were like the same thing. The score reading is where someone puts a piece of music in front of you, usually an orchestra piece, actually always an orchestra piece, and you have to condense a full orchestra to two or four hands. That was hard. But that's what opera accompanists do. A lot of times they're looking at the score. They're not. They might be reading a vocal score, but sometimes that's not one available, and they will have to condense an entire score. Just as it's reading it like that. Like that's. You have a lot of choices to make in your head as you do that. It's crazy. And then the keyboard harmony was also great because that focused more on the bass line and numbers that were underneath them called figured bass. Or, you know, they're just like numerals that told you what intervals were above the bass.
Right.
And then sometimes no melody. And you would be able to play a melody just from the bass line and the numbers underneath it, the figured bass. That was also very crazy to me to learn. And that's actually, you know, that's something that's very old. It's an old kind of pedagogy, but it's still something that is kind of permeated throughout many styles and genres of music.
What's the advantage of reading figured bass?
Well, figured bass is definitely like very specific. Like no music is really notated that like that now, unless you're trying to work in the style of Bach or like Baroque music, because that's where it originates. But it does come in handy reading pop music, I think, or like jazz standards, because those numbers are the same as like seeing something like C6-4. A lot of times you wouldn't even see that in a pop standard. It'd probably be like C over G. But it just, like, if you can do figured bass, you can understand any variation of that, because the figured bass is the most pure and technical notation for, I think, what is it? I guess it'd be like abbreviated chords. That's really what it is. I think people were kind of lazy. But at the same time, it's not that they were lazy. It's just that in the time of the Baroque era, weirdly enough, people who are keyboard players would be playing a lot, but they like to improvise a little bit. They like to add little ornaments. The Baroque era was filled with these stylistic ornaments, both in music but also in the visual art. So they like to kind of riff off these chords. So if they just have like the bare minimum of what you need to convey the emotion and music by the composer, then you can kind of riff, you can do whatever you want. And that's like jazz now, like pop music, you get a chord, a lead sheet, which has all the chord symbols with the melody. Ironically, they're written above. So it's a little bit flipped, but it means the same thing. You read it, it gives you bare minimum information, but you implement all sorts of characteristics of that musical style or genre, and that's the song. So it's just another way of conveying something that's already in our head, because music, as you've pointed out before, is like, I forget how you described it. It's like in the ether, and you have to will it into existence by playing it. And so sometimes sheet music helps us remember what we did. So that's really all it's for.
Yeah, I think we're all antennas that can pick up a whole lot of different frequencies, and I feel that we have a choice which kind we are tuning into, and that music is just one of those different stations or frequencies. And yeah, there's a, you know, hopefully not too much labor involved, but there is an element of willing it into existence.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we want it to be in existence, but like, just like music is not a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was getting at. And it's like, it doesn't exist until you make it exist by pressing play or pressing keys on a piano.
I've had this thought that ideas can sound so universal that it's almost like whoever receives them, it's sort of irrelevant. In other words, you hear a song on the radio, that's just a great song, and you can almost separate it from the person and go, that could have been their song or this person's song. Because the truth that comes from that tuning into whatever that is that gives you the ideas, what you pull down is so universal. It just seems like it could have been anyone's song or idea.
I mean, that kind of opens up a whole can of worms on, like, where does music actually come from? And in that obviously, the answer would be, I was about to say obviously humans, but, like, you know, people might argue differently. But I think music is, you can use, like, the universe or nature as an analogy, like, to music. Like, you can compare them and, like, use music as an analogy, like, you know, the universe working in harmony. But I think music is human. Like we don't listen. Like, you can appreciate those sprinklers off in the distance for their rhythm and their, like, syncopation. But that's not music. And this is something I get into arguments about with, like, people who like the Fluxus movement or people who go to Cal Arts, because they're just like, it's all in good fun, because it's an interesting conversation, like, and it doesn't matter one way or another, because we still like it for what it is. But, like, it's just an interesting conversation, because, like, I think I like to give us the credit for making music, but I do think beyond that, like, if we can agree on that, then we can go deeper into that and be like, what's giving us this? What are we hearing? And, like, people can go, like, I don't necessarily believe in God. I don't believe that there's no God either. But I think, like, we are, like, vessels that just spit out the music. We're not really, like, responsible wholly. Like, I think it's just something that was there. We had to, like, see it and find it and then bring it to Earth.
Interesting. So some people are willing to say music was there all along, and that other beings can perceive it other than humans. Is that it? Is that the argument?
Well, like, snakes don't make music.
But, right.
But they can slither, like, and, like, you know, make his little sounds. And maybe they can respond to, like, the musical vibrations. Like, if, you know, you know, you can make a snake come out of a hat or something. Or whatever they come out of, bags in like, Egypt. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, you can make a snake.
I think it's baskets.
Actually. Basket, yeah. So you have, like, a neigh. Those vibrations tell the snake to get out of that basket.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's because they want to dance. I think it's because they've been taught, you know, like, something good happens when that happens, or, like, who
right.
knows? I don't know. I think there's like vibrations. Vibrations are so interesting. There's vibrations we don't even comprehend or even notice, but the ones that we do in the small range we are even capable of hearing, there's so much that does happen. So, like, I think what I was getting at is, not only are humans responsible for music, but we have a responsibility to, like, deliver it properly, like, and, like, with humility and grace.
I agree with you. Animals can recognize patterns. They can recognize, like, repetition and sequences, but that doesn't mean they're perceiving it as music.
I think some animals do like music, though, because, like, well, or at least they don't mind it.
Mm-hmm.
like my brother's cat. I used to live with my brother, and I would play the piano, and my cat would just come sit by the, you know, she was a very standoffish cat. She didn't like people. She didn't like loud noises. But even if I was practicing drums, she would just come and watch in the corner, just like kind of like be like, or just like sit on the floor watching.
Same with my dog.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, dogs obviously I think are very close to humans. They respond nicely. And they like rhythm. I think a lot of animals like rhythm because it's kind of built into us inherently, with our hearts. Anything that has a heart will appreciate rhythm, specifically a steady beat. And beat is different from rhythm, but like I think we all have a sense of rhythm because of a heartbeat. And harmony is more of an analogy, but I feel like that is the things that unites us and allows us to be free a lot of the time. And then melody is like the story a lot of the time, or it's like the narrative. Or like, you know, with the foreground material. And so that the melody, I think, is in a way the most mysterious, because that I do think can come from nature as well. So, I go back and forth between this. So, like, I'm contradicting myself now, like, because I'd like to say that music is humanity, and that may be true, but also, like, nature provides so much evidence for the foundations of music, like the overtone series, harmonic series, that can give, not only give harmony, but also melody. And then, yeah, that's actually where you get most melody in nature.
Hard for me to pick a side, too. I think they pick it up in a way where obviously they don't know music as a concept, but they can feel a kind of like safety and predictability and sort of like cyclical kind of nature of it. So it's almost irrelevant whether they understand that that's what music is, because it's still getting them on a physical level. It's still causing something to happen in them other than, you know, like a fear response that would happen from the sound of a different animal being nearby. Or it's just a, like, it's a, it's like a completely new way to interpret sound for both humans and animals, because we both have this like primal nature where sounds usually convey information, and usually it can be dangerous information, like based on, you know, how animals are. And so I think because of that, when you play animals' music, they still can feel it as something other than what they're used to, and something that actually you know, mellows them out. And I think that's close enough to say that they can listen to music. And on a subconscious level, they definitely know what it is because they know what it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's interesting, like, what would a, you know, a cat, or, you know, let's say like a gerbil. What if you started playing like Metallica really loud? Do you think it'll enjoy that?
I don't think so. I think there's a line, obviously, you know, because Metallica is something that's more geared towards the human ear. That doesn't mean it's like artificialized at all. It's just, it's metal is kind of a human convention. And I just don't think they would respond to that in the same way that they would respond to piano or something.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. It's funny though how like humans have built this, like we've progressed so much with our taste in music that we will listen to just about anything.
Yeah.
Call it music. But sure. The thing is, metal is actually very sophisticated. Like, I love metal, like, for the record. Like, I have a deep appreciation for really good metal bands that, like, siren. That, well, what I've noticed about metal bands is that their music is really well thought out. Like, rhythmically, harmonically, like, structurally, it's a lot more in depth than most music you hear. It resembles more of the idioms of like classic rock, but a little bit more with an edge. Mm-hmm. So, and very technically demanding. So whoever is a metal musician is usually a really good musician.
Yeah, and probably has to be in shape. I think.
Yeah.
Some genres you can get away with not being in shape. Whatever being in shape means, I guess for this, I just mean, you know, flexibility and endurance, mostly. And also strength, I guess. It's a different kind of strength. But, yeah, I think it's understated how demanding music can be physically, even if it's not like demanding in the same way a workout is.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I've started like weeding out my like gigging life, because I hate carrying shit around. Like, I hate schlepping. Like someone else do that for me, please. I don't get paid enough to do that. Usually, sometimes. Well, what's great though is like some gigs, there is somebody that does that for you. They set up like all like the big things, and then you just come in like several minutes before, and you're good to go. I love that. That's the best. But not all the time. I don't get those gigs all the time. So. I just enjoy them when I can, but I mean, all the gigs are fun, but it's more interesting for me to like figure out other ways to create music and do all those things without having to endure so much physical labor.
There should be an easier way for every kind of musician. And man, I wish there was a way for like every public place to be some kind of venue for someone, and they just have to basically sign in to an app, and then basically, boom, you're a working musician, and you play a set and you get a rate based on like your experience and like the type of place. But it's sort of like, it's simple. Like, there aren't so many different ways to, like, it would just be a fair way. Hard to agree on what you would pay in that kind of situation, but I feel like there should be a way to figure that out, so people could just like the old days, but like an evolved version. You can roll up to places and find a time slot that day or that week, and then you can go do it and then be compensated for it.
There actually are a fair amount of opportunities like that here in LA.
Yeah.
But what I find with them is that you'll go to these things, and here's like actual story. I played like this really cute like R&B set, kind of like pop vibes R&B. And then the next band that comes is a metal, like hard rock, hard band, like totally different vibe. And it's just like, there's no like real cohesion between all the acts. And that's the only thing about it. Like, it's nice that there's all these people can come to one place, and it's usually a nice sound setup or whatever, but it can be a little bit of a hodgepodge sometimes.
Well, that's why I'm saying there should be like a standard where you know what kind of music you'd be playing when you sign up, and venues are allowed to have their preference, and there's also like a vetting process of like what you know, and then that also affects the venues that are available for you to go and play.
There's got to be an app like this.
I don't know, man. If there is, it's not that popular yet, because we would probably know about it, especially living here.
Now, I wanted to make a piano teaching app. But first of all, there's already a lot of those. But like, I wanted to make it be like an Uber for piano teachers.
It's funny you say that, because that's kind of what I'm saying, but for performers.
Yeah. So, that's what made me think of it. But it would have been like, it's like, it allows it so that it'd be for both the teacher and the student. And you can order your teacher, and the teacher will get a notification like a driver does. And it's just like, all right, cool. And then like everything, like all the billing and stuff, like all the overhead is taken care of because it's an app. And that's the only thing, because like as you know, as a piano teacher, there's a lot of extra work you have to do to just make sure everyone's paying you. I mean, I don't know what your system is, but I've tried out different systems with different clients just to see which one I like, and then I change them over time.
It's getting closer to what you're talking about, but we're still everything still has too many steps.
Yeah.
But albeit fewer than there were.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps not, because, you know, some things get simpler, other things get more complicated. So, what things have you, you know, like what kind of, how have you updated your process with those sorts of things? Like, what takes you more time to do than you'd like to? For me, it's not that many things. I just have to communicate with people, which just requires realizing you have to do that and then reaching out, but sometimes that's It's hard to even keep track of that.
It is, especially like when you're the only person working at your business or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, you don't have anyone to help you really. So that you have a lot of like, you have to have a lot of confidence a lot of the time. But like something I thought about doing that I just started doing with one of my clients is having them pay for like four or five lessons in advance. So it's like, I'm guaranteed, like, we're going to have these lessons. Or you paid me for it already. Like, it's your loss.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that you were previously doing it that way. Because I thought, when you work for institutions like the one in Santa Monica, did they do monthly? Or
it is bi-monthly.
I see. So yeah. After that, you kind of went to a different model for that?
No, I maintained that model.
Two at a time?
Like every two, after the two.
After the two.
I've also done every lesson just right after, like you sent it to me, which that's like neutral, I feel. Not great, though.
I allow some clients to do that just so until they're comfortable like working with me, because they don't know me. So like some people, you know, I try to just like respect where they're coming from and say, okay, well, they'll warm up to this in a few weeks.
Warm up to what?
Well, for instance, like if someone's not used to paying for lessons, they may just want to pay one at a time for like the first two or three. And then they'll be able to determine if it's for them, and then from then on you've established a rapport with them and, you know, the beginnings of a relationship, so that they can trust you and send you a whole month.
Yeah, and I think that's more of a decision for themselves. Like, do they see themselves practicing? And, you know,
100%.
I feel like with children, they're a lot more consistent. Like, clients who have children, like, adults are not, and I don't blame them. Like, if I were an adult, I'd be upfront, and my teacher would be like, I'm probably going to I just want to, like, catch up a little bit. I don't want, like, lessons for the rest of my life. Like, when you're a child, it feels like that. It's like, did you have music lessons as a kid?
Mm-hmm. I had them in fifth and sixth grade. And then, again, starting after a couple years of guitar, which was when I was like 17, I started again. And then studied with teachers up till now, and I'm still doing it. But there was a time in high school where I just was happy to figure it out for myself, and, you know, I got far enough doing that. Helped me come into my own as like an autodidact. And you know, because because you are your best teacher. As valuable as other teachers are, they're really just trying to show you what you can discover about yourself. And so, where was I going with this?
Well, I mean, I was just asking about, like, well, I mean, I asked you about that because, like, I also had music lessons as a kid.
It was just,
like, a thing that was part of my life, like, brushing my teeth. Like, it was so ingrained in my schedule. Like, I was having 2 lessons a week for a while. But then it was just, like, one was a instrumental lesson, and then one was a music theory composition lesson. And this was with one particular teacher I had, whose name is Richard Warren. And we had, like, long-ass lessons. They were always at least 2 hours. It'd be, like... But he would only charge for, like, the one lesson rate. He just, like, we just really, like, had a different kind of bond. So I was very lucky for that. And that became just something that was so ingrained. Like, it feels weird not having him now, but now I'm the teacher, and I also still feel like the student, because I'm learning these things. I'm, like, relearning a lot of concept with my students. And I try to make exercises for them that are, like, tailored, like, for the student. Kind of just for me, too, just, like, to test myself and, like, challenge myself and make me think a little bit outside the box. But I think what the whole point in bringing all this stuff about lessons as a child is that I think it makes sense for a client who's a child to pay for multiple lessons in advance, because there probably are. Like, a lot of times most of my students don't cancel. Only if they're a little older did they do that. Mm-hmm. Or if they're in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an understood. So I might start doing that. But I usually try not to, like, change after we, like, figure out a system, because if it doesn't really affect anything, really, or, like, you know, just consistency is nice. But, some, you know, changing once a good way is fine, I'm sure. So that's what I'm about to embark on. I've done that with, like, one or two clients now, and it was fine. So I feel a bit more confident to proceed in that way. Maybe I should just start doing ads like you, though. I've never done that. It's just because I've been doing it for so long, like, since I was 16. And so they just, like, chain reaction over time. Like, the longer time goes, just spreads.
I heard somewhere that different business owners have built their businesses on just flyering alone. In like a major city, of course, because that would, well, maybe not, because you know you need the you need a lot of people. Of course. So, you know, not every method is a method that you have to, that's going to cost you. Like, thank God we have good printers, because that was my method. I didn't even use ads that much. I tried it, but
Where'd you put your flyers?
Coffee shops, libraries, delis, pharmacies, bookstores, salons, gyms, and I'm sure others.
And how many did you print?
Over the course of doing that, hundreds, I'm sure. Not thousands. The people I was just talking about, they've done thousands, and I see how that would create awareness about something that you have to offer. Like, I know we're all just sort of geared into, like, looking at our phones all the time, but, like, flyering creates a lot of awareness. Like, people are still looking around, and, you know.
We were yesterday at that juice shop. You saw the business cards and stuff, like martial arts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What information did you put on the flyer, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, it's I put two photos on. I can send you the one I have. And then my contact information in one corner.
Which was?
Cell phone number, email, and YouTube and Instagram. And then I say I have a sort of like a title or like a hook in, you know, big font, music lessons. And then I have a list of instruments that I offer and a short blurb about my experience. It's not even full sentences. It's just things that I've done. And then a QR code right in the middle. And then other than that, I even added like my own quote that I came up with that I thought was kind of clever and wholesome, and I put that on it too. And that was enough. Oh, it's I don't want to butcher it. So
the people want to know now.
It was something to the effect of music enriches the soul, sharpens the mind, and softens the heart.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's good, actually. Yeah, that's good. That's very nice. Yeah. No, I'd love to see that flyer.
Yeah.
I'd just get some inspiration. Because I seriously might do that. LA seems so big, though. I'm just like, how? But also, it's not. You know, it's just like any old place. It's just a bunch of little places all smushed together.
You can advertise remote lessons and provide that alternative, and some people are more than happy to do that and are happy to learn that way, especially if they call you and they're like, hey, I want to study with you, and you look at your schedule and you're like, well, I don't know how I would get to you based on your availability and based on my route, because it's like I can't get over to Burbank on Tuesday because I'm in Santa Monica or whatever. If you have that problem, then you can say, this is all I can do is virtual lessons. But listen, if it's virtual, that means I have more of a window, like I have more availability. So like, even though you're not in person, you still give them the choice of when. So some people still love virtual because there's that element of flexibility.
Yeah, virtual lessons are like so close. Like I like teaching them because it's like more convenient, honestly. I mean, pretty much like that's the main reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't have to, like, take a shower, per se. Like, I also have a lot more tools, in a way, at my hand, my fingertips. So that's awesome. Like, I love that. And in person is nice, too, because you can draw stuff and, like, be right next to them, and the real time is good. But the only thing that I wish – is I could just see more in the virtual lessons. Because I feel like it's a lot to ask for students to like be like, oh, can you like set up like a second camera like above your fingers so I can see them? So I've gotten really good at like being able to just know a lot about someone's sound just by what I'm hearing, not even what I'm seeing. I don't know if you have that.
I have that. I because some students ask, hey, can you see me okay? Like, is this a good angle? And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Remember, it's more about, like, I can hear you fine, so it's more about, can you see what I'm doing on the screen? Can you hear me okay? And so, yeah, it's really close. Some people love that presence of another human next to them. And I gotta say, I understand that. But you can learn virtually. It takes a certain kind of mind and attitude.
And it is harder for young children to do that.
Yeah.
They get distracted, and I don't blame them. I get distracted. I remember doing a couple of virtual lessons when I was still in school. They were composition lessons, but it was still like didn't feel quite real because they were just pixels. Even though they were there somewhere in the world, they're just pixels on my screen, and I was interacting with them. So I think still I like in person a little bit better at this point, because it's just because I'm also like I don't communicate much outside of real life. Like I don't text much, I don't call much with anybody, let alone a client. So like. It's one of my students that I've had for a while now. We only have virtual lessons. We used to have in-person lessons for like a couple of years, but then now since the pandemic, it's only been virtual. But like, in a way, we're almost closer than ever because they've been growing up in front of my eyes. You know, I've seen them grow, their voice get deeper. But now they text me like, hey, like, do you think I could play this? And that's kind of cool. Like, I encourage that kind of communication, but I still would like to see them in person, because then I can help them more, probably. Because sometimes, like, I'll be trying to describe, like, no, curve your finger, like a certain way. And it's in person, I'd want to be like... touching their fingers, like in ballet. When I was doing ballet, my teacher would like come like point, you know, fix my leg extension in some way that I would have never been able to figure out otherwise. Like, it felt weird, but it can be weird these days because people think everything is like, you don't want to get like Me Too'd. But I think that you kind of need some like physical, like some touch sometimes just to like feel what it's like to like have a certain kind of motion or position. And there's like, it's no words can help you like convey that.
Yeah. Well said. But hey, if they're open to it, then you can make it available to them. And as important as the technical side is, the students are also just looking for an experience of music, and so, you know, while they value that, they're happy to be there to learn a whole lot of other things about it too, where that can be communicated a little bit more easily than the technical side, which requires a lot of touch. So,
yeah,
like take the software we have, Midiculous. Think of how helpful that is for a visual learner. Almost, you know, if you can sit there and focus on the screen like you could watching someone's hands, it may even convey more information, just because you can see, you know, the keys are lighting up, so you really have a clear demonstration right before your eyes.
Yeah, the ultimate way to teach probably would be all those things combined, like a virtual reality.
Yeah,
that'd probably be the ultimate way, because you're in person, basically, for all intents and purposes. You can get every angle, you can, like, I mean, I don't know if we're at the point where, like, our fingers are seen yet. I don't think they are, actually. But maybe in some ways they are, I'm not sure. But that way is cool, because then you can, like, be, like, in the same room, virtual room, and move around, but also, like, right up on the wall or whatever.
Yeah. I think we're going to have 4D hologram pianos, where you just, like, set up the projector and something responds to your fingertips, so you get a feeling of weighted keys.
I think something like that already exists.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's like a light that just sits right here, and then you, like, just tap on the... It's like it projects, like, a...
Wow, what is it? What's it called?
I don't know what it's called. I just have seen it before. But, I might be able to find it on a quick Google search.
Just imagine you're on your way somewhere. You're on a bus, or, like, on a train or an airplane, and you can just bust this out, and you don't need to bring anything with you.
Hologram piano.
Holy shit.
So it already exists. And not only, it just projects from your phone.
That's what I'm talking
about. It's not even anything special.
So is there any kind of sensation that you get as you probably not.
No, there's no sensation.
But that doesn't really
matter.
But
I think you get some sort of thing, because the piano fills with color when you press it. So there is some sort of, like, thing that happens that, you know, you can kind of feel.
Well, they're already doing it. Someone's going to do it really well, and we're all going to have it in just a matter of time with all kinds of instruments.
Well, I've been seeing these Instagram ads for this musical duo that's like EDM or whatever, but like they combine all sorts of like live playing, like all the sounds they're doing are created live, or like they're performed. It's not just like pressing space bar and letting the music play. So, and one of the instruments they have is literally just the room is dark, and these lasers, like 8 or 9 lasers, are pointing up in the sky, and like when they put their hand through, that makes it sound, and then they, like, the modulation comes up when they move their hand up, or the volume, or like if they shake it, like, changes things. So some of these, all these cool technology and innovations happening that just kind of make the process more intuitive. It's very cool. I'm very curious what instruments will be around in the future, and if people will actually use them.
Yeah.
Cause like the instruments really haven't changed that much over time. They have, but like not really. You either bow it, press it, hit it, blow it, like blow through it or something. You know, air, there's the categories of instruments. So with the electronic, the use of electronics, it's almost, there's a lot more possibilities, that's for sure.
I'm going to get that hologram piano. It had a 1-star review, yeah. So I'm kind of skeptical. But
we gotta do a review. Like, hey guys, welcome to my review of hologram piano app. You ever thought about doing that? Doing YouTube reviews?
If it felt natural, like if I felt compelled to talk about something, then sure, but it looks like a lot of work.
I mean, usually those things are just like promotions.
Yeah.
Like they're like the people don't even care about it.
If I used something a lot and someone would pay me to promote it, then I would happily do it. But I couldn't promote like this is brought to you by Diet Coke. Like
I would do it. I would fucking do it. Write me the check, Diet Coke. Response for what?
Maybe I would. I don't know. Root beer, I suppose.
Well, like, yeah, I don't know. I definitely, you know, you can't beat them, join them. That's what they. It's not always a good rule of thumb. But I'm ready to sell my soul. I live in LA. I live in Hollywood. It's just a matter of time. No, I'm just kidding. But I'll still have integrity to whatever I do, no matter what.
I think that this is how we should close out about selling our souls.
Mm-hmm. I think the camera died, by the way.
I think so, too. Oh, well. Either the camera died or the mic died.
I heard a sound. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we got something nice.
Yeah. That was like 30 minutes ago.
Okay. Well, I'll use what we got. Yeah, this was fun.
It was fun. I don't know how much people want to hear about like billing processes with piano teaching.
Who knows? I think it's just a nice way to document what we're thinking.
But these are the problems we have. these are the issues. They're not even problems. They're just like the things that are going on in our lives.
People are more curious about that than you think, because people just want to people are just curious about how those things compare to what's going on in their life, even if it's mundane. You know, like people will relate, so whatever, we can talk about that. That's what's happening, and what's happening is what people want to hear about. So, with that, let's sign off.
Cheerio.
Cheerio. Bye, everybody.